Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Professor Barbara D. Savage. She's a historian and the Geraldine R. Siegel Professor of American Social Thought at the University of Pennsylvania. And we're talking about her latest book. It's an amazing history. Merce Tate, The Global Odyssey of a Black Woman Scholar. Professor Savage, how did this story come to you?
Hi, thank you so much. And that is actually probably the hardest question to answer after all these years of working on her. But I was vaguely familiar with her by name and her work as a scholar, because I've done so much work at Howard University in Washington, where she taught for most of her academic career. And I sort of stumbled into some of her work online as I was looking for something else. And what became clear to me almost immediately, thanks to the magic of digitization, is that here is a woman who was an extraordinary scholar and who had published widely and whose body of work I did not know. And as a scholar of African-American history, and Tate as an African-American scholar, I was a little taken aback that I did not know about her, and certainly not as much as I was to learn and over the course of the decade to follow. So that's the short story, and she is part of a larger interest that I have had in helping to recuperate the lives of scholars, in particular Black women, who have been lost to history. And she certainly fits into that category.
In the introduction, you write that this book follows, quote, the desire lines of Merce's life. Talk to me what that means.
Desire lines is actually an architectural term, which I did not know, but which I learned in the course, actually, of doing this research at Howard University. And it refers to what I would think of as shortcuts or pathways off of very straight sidewalks and lines and very carefully laid out walkways at universities or towns or wherever, and desire lines are what it sounds like. It's where we veer because we want to go a different way. And I see that as a really fitting metaphor for her life and her decisions to basically create a pathway for herself. This is a Black woman born in 1905 in Michigan who somehow comes up with this idea that she wants to be a scholar and a world traveler, and then sets out, with a brilliant mind and a very strong will to make that happen. So in many ways, this book follows the desire lines of that life, and it's been a privilege to be able, to do that. But that's what I think that actually is why I use that concept in the introduction. It still feels very fitting to me in describing the surprising places that she went in her life.
From my personal reading of the book, I just came away with the feeling is that she was just a fierce intellectual. I mean, nothing stood in her way. She was courage and intellectual personified. She graduated Columbia Teachers College, studied international relations, University of Oxford, earned her PhD in government from Harvard, and then, as you mentioned, was the professor at Howard University for 35 years and did all this writing, too. What was her early upbringing like that produced this kind of scholar?
She was born into a family of Black farmers in the middle of Michigan. And because, as she would say, she was born in Michigan and not in Mississippi at that point, at that time in our history, she actually had access to a very good elementary and secondary education in Michigan, and then was able to go to college there as well in the late 1920s, and certainly at a time when most African Americans who were then still living in the South would not have had that opportunity. So she had an opportunity for the education, but she was born with a kind of intellectual prowess and a brilliance and a particular kind of personal drive that she brought to all of that, and almost an insatiable intellectual curiosity. And so we see that, you know, throughout her life, both in terms of the topics that she's interested in writing about, the places she wants to go and see herself. So I think that your term of calling her a fierce intellectual is entirely correct. And I wish I had thought of that myself, but that is in fact who she was and what she was. So some of it is born, a lot of it is made, and she was someone who took advantage of every opportunity that came her way, and someone who refused to say no when opportunities seemed to be foreclosed for her.
Well, let's just talk about one small example early in her career. She was determined to study at Oxford University. Now, at that time, for a black woman, there were enormous obstacles. You're talking a mostly white male setting. Talk to me about how she went about this. It was amazing. She just never gave up.
It is in fact a testament to her fortitude that she got there. She would say, and this is also true, that she was naive to even think that she could go. And I think sometimes naivete can be one of our greatest tools. Because she didn't know she couldn't go, she went about figuring out how she could go. And so she was able to go because the recommendations from women, in particular white women, who had trained her and who were involved with trying to send a few American women to Oxford in that period. And so she kind of cobbled all of that together. She was able to afford to go because of black women in her sorority, the Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority, which also Vice President Kamala Harris is also a member of that sorority.
Right.
But they set up an international fellowship for $1,000, and she won that, and she was able to use that to help pay for her move and her studying at Oxford. But you're right, this was a time when there were very, very few women at Oxford. And, of course, fewer still were people of color of any kind. She was the only black American woman there during the time she studied. And so she was admitted and welcomed, and there were women there who were also very dedicated to working with her and making what she wanted to do possible. But at every stage, it was extraordinarily unlikely that someone who looked like her, who came from where she came from, would be able to succeed, and yet she found a way to do it.
And that was only the beginning of her career, because she did other things after. She was also a relentless traveler. And I want to talk just about some of the places. I mean, she published books on race in Europe and the United States, imperialism in Asia and the Pacific and Africa. But she traveled to all these places, and she always wanted to get a feel for the place, it seemed. Is that true?
She needed to see things for herself, and she's that kind of person. And so she wanted to go and see her for herself. She was a photographer, so she always had a camera, yeah, both a still and a moving a camera. And she was able, as you say, to travel around the world twice, once east to west and once west to east. And so some of the travel was related to, as you just lined out, the variety of places and parts of the world that she was studying academically. So, of course, you need to go and see that and to do archival work. But she also was just an extraordinary tourist, in that she seemed to have had some list of all of the places and natural wonders and architectural wonders of the world and engineering wonders that she wanted to see. And it was a childlike fascination. She had it from childhood, and she was able to realize that, you know, as an adult. And so, yes, she went everywhere as a solo traveler, and it was one of the great joys of her life.
Now, she traveled to Germany in the 1930s. Now, that, when I started reading that, that scared me to death. Like, that's a dangerous time to be in Germany. Talk to me about what she found there.
Yes, in 1935, when she took her degree from Oxford, she went to Berlin to study to improve her German. This was not as unusual as I thought it was when I first encountered it with her. It was fairly routine for Americans in that period, at the end of their time at Oxford, or others, to, in fact, go to Germany. And so she was following a pretty well-trod path. I think in hindsight, we can see so much more clearly why that was not a good idea. But in the middle of the coming of Nazi Germany, she ends up there in the summer of 1935 and is part of, as I said, a school of students who are studying the language. And as a part of that, she's required to go where those students are required to go, and that included in one case actually going to a rally at the Sports Palace and witnessing Hitler. And it was a very chilling, as you can imagine, experience for her, and it's one that she talked about for the rest of her life, you know, with great sorrow and horror at what she witnessed and what was being unveiled so clearly to her at that time in 1935.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Professor Barbara D. Savage. She is a historian and the Geraldine R. Siegel Professor of American Social Thought at the University of Pennsylvania. And we're talking about her latest book. It's a dynamic biography. Mayrs Tate, The Global Odyssey of a Black Woman Scholar. She had an interest in Hawaii. And I don't know why I find that surprising, because she sort of had an interest in the entire world. But what was her particular interest in Hawaii?
Well, she first went to Hawaii in 1951 on her way back from having spent a year in India on a Fulbright. She had conceived of this idea of doing a project on imperialism in the Pacific, a really big, big study. And she realized once she visited Hawaii that she could actually do that analysis based on the United States rather than European nations, but the United States' involvement in that region, and in particular in Hawaii, first through the settlement of missionaries in the 1820s, and then eventually the annexation of Hawaii, and then, of course, statehood much later in the century. And so she approached it as a scholar who was interested in American imperialism and our own attempts to establish colonies abroad in ways that we pretty much had associated with European nations instead. And so that was why she was drawn to that work, and that's actually one of the really important interventions that she makes by shifting the focus to what the United States is actually doing in other regions of the world, including the Pacific.
Well, and she had a lot of different interests in other topics, too. She had an interest in the expansion of railroads and their connection to imperialism. Can you just flesh that out?
This was one of the final work of her life, in that she was always interested in how imperialism or colonization actually worked on the ground, like the tools of imperialism. And so she had written about arms and armaments and navies, you know, some of her earlier work. But she also, I think, in a very creative way, in the 1970s, began to realize that the infrastructure that was being laid out by international corporations in Africa, for example, was really another form of imperialism. And she saw the railroads, as she called them, sinews and arteries of empire.
Wow.
Because to control the railroads, to be able to move labor, to be able to move all of those extraordinary natural resources out from the centers in the interior of Africa to the coast and to deep sea ports. And so international corporate capital was the form of imperialism that she was interested in, particularly in post-independence Africa. When we think Africa is newly liberated, and yet she's warning of this particular manifestation of international corporate capitalism. And that's what she, that's her, her kind of interest in railways is
that's
a very, I thought, a very creative and prescient way of thinking about that.
That's exactly the way I felt too. Now she visited Africa. She visited Liberia, Kenya, Ethiopia, Tanzania, what was called at that time Rhodesia, which is now I think Zimbabwe, and even South Africa and Zanzibar. It would take us several shows to do her, her trip and what she thought about the different countries in Africa. But I want to pick out two. What did she think about South Africa at that time? And she visited at the time of apartheid?
She did. Well, of course, yes, she did. And I, it was one of the kind of puzzling things for me, because this is someone who she had taught African history. She taught about Africa. She taught courses on Africa and imperialism the whole time at Howard. So it, it was incongruous to me that she would travel to South Africa. And I grew up in a period of sort of free South Africa, and a period of the strength of the anti-apartheid movement, which she would have been very well aware of as well. And so what we see here is her basically privileging her need to go research, meet the people who are actually on the ground and putting in place all of these international corporate structures. And so I think I came to think that she went there under ruse, that she really that she was being duplicitous in the sense that she went and had to appear one way for the officials in the South African government, but underneath that was this ulterior motive of writing this fairly vicious critique, not vicious, this fairly stringent critique of those corporations and of American capitalist and international investment there. So, but it did throw me for a loop, because it was inconsistent with her own politics, which I, you know, which had been very strongly pro-African independence for as long as I, you know, had studied her, as long as she had written about it.
You only mentioned this in almost in passing, but I was fascinated by her visit to Zanzibar because it was a former slave port. Did she write about what she felt when she went there?
I didn't. She didn't write about it. I was able to recover what she thought about it, because she talked about it much later in an oral interview towards the end of her life. And so we see her there encountering it's actually a scene that's much more associated with the west coast of Africa and with the slave ports of entry, if you will, and exit there. But she encountered it there where you, and it's the same sort of encounter where you can put yourself, if you will, in the mind, or at least you can see what enslaved people saw for the last time on those shores. And I think she found it very moving and was very poignant, and she was also very saddened by it. But it did happen in Zanzibar rather than in Ghana, which is where we most often associate that.
Nairobi was, she declared, was her favorite city in the continent of Africa. Do you know why? What was it about Nairobi at that time?
Well, Nairobi, and I've visited Nairobi not recently, and certainly maybe about a decade or so after she did. But it's a vibrant, beautiful city, and a cosmopolitan city. And I could see why it would be, you know, so appealing to her in terms of the mix of influences and architecture. And she spent more time in the south and east of Africa than West Africa, although she did visit Nigeria or Lagos at one point. And so I think she just had she went to Nairobi more than once, and she was also welcomed there by other Black Americans who, by the time she traveled, were serving as ambassadors or serving in foreign service positions there. Thanks in part, eventually to Jimmy Carter. And so it was an interesting and welcoming and warm place for her to be able to to visit and to use it as a base, and then to go out to what we now think of as game parks and to see all of the natural beauty that's also within reach once you're in Nairobi.
Now, I don't want to pass up this The Black Woman's Oral History Project. Can you talk about that?
Yes, it's actually it's a project that she was involved in at the end of the 1970s at Harvard and Radcliffe at the Schlesinger Library, and it's just like what it sounds like. It was a project to try to capture the lives of women like Tate, who were born in the 1930s or born at the turn of the century, and who were able to put together interesting lives in the 20th century despite segregation and discrimination. And she was an advisor to that project, ended up being someone who was interviewed for it, and also someone who interviewed seven other women in the project. And that the project as a whole is really a foundational collection for Black women's history. And I will also say that her interview in that project is absolutely essential to my being able to write this biography, even as I also, you know, very aggressively fact-checked her as best I could. But it was because at that point this is done in the late 1970s. She's in her late 70s. And so she's also then able to recapitulate a life or to look back on a very long life. And that's a particularly valuable stance for a biographer to have access to in terms of how she's beginning to think about what she's done and why it's important, even if I veer from some of her own, you know, her own conclusions about that.
One of the interesting things I read about in your book was when there was a student takeover at Howard in 1968, she had a sort of a nuanced appreciation of it. She was uncomfortable about their tactics.
She was, and I would say that she would not be unusual, right alongside other members of her generation. That it's not an uncommon reaction that I have seen among other Black scholars at other institutions, but at Howard it was particularly stark because the student movement there was so effective and also so influential. So she did not disagree with what they were asking for, which included curriculum changes that would give more attention to Black history, to African history. And so she wasn't comfortable with the tactics or the strategy, but she wasn't opposed to the outcome. And I think, as I said earlier, one of her responses was to begin to offer this new course on imperialism in Africa, which was aimed at those students, in which they much appreciated, and it gave them a forum to discuss so many contemporary issues that they also were concerned about internationally.
What I also love about your book is you really have a lot of insights into the person beyond her intellect. You write that she was a great bridge player, which I loved learning. She was a great chef and a party giver.
She was all of that. In fact, she is embedded in a world that is invisible to many people. But she was a part of a very large and rich world of college-educated Black people who socialized with one another, in part because of segregation. And it's not as if people could just roll out and go to any restaurant they wanted to go to.
Yeah.
So much of socializing was done privately in homes and organized clubs, and bridge was one of those the activities that was, you know, was very popular in the U.S. in general in the 30s and 40s and including among African Americans. So she learned it in the 1920s, and she played it all of her life. She saw it as another international language. She could play with people whose languages she could not speak. And it was a great joy and a challenge, I think, for her, both mentally, and it was a great social outlet for her.
Oh, it's the most intellectual card game you can have. So I was completely unsurprised that she would do that.
I learned that the hard way, because as being a dutiful biographer, I actually tried to learn to play bridge. I took bridge class, two of them. I have no gift for it. And I did learn what makes a good bridge player, and it's all the things I knew about her, which is that she had a good mind for mathematics, for strategy, and also for nearly photographic memory.
She was even a poet at times, and you have that in your book too.
you see that she's part of that generation of that's trained in sonnets and Shakespeare and all of the kind of traditional Western canon, in addition to African-American poets. And so she grew up, I'm sure, as she grew up having learned and memorized so much of that literature that she then herself, in the book, I think I reproduce three
That's
sonnets
right. Yes,
that
you did.
She wrote as part of her going to and from Oxford. And so it was a way for her to kind of capture her own emotional reaction to what was going on around her, and I include them in the book for that purpose. I don't judge them as, I'm not a literary critic, and I don't judge them as poetry in that way, but they are. I thought they were really valuable to include for, you know, they were valuable to me, and I would think they would be valuable to every reader.
She passed on at 91, and I was actually... It was really sad to read that, even though you obviously knew what was happening. But what a life she lived. And was she honored after her death?
She was, and she has been in many ways. I think still not as much as she deserves as a scholar, and I'm hoping that my work will help do that. But she was honored by the American Historical Association, her
Excellent.
Hometown named a library after her, which I saw. Western Michigan University named a college after her. There's now Merz Tate College there.
Excellent.
And Oxford has also named a couple of spaces for her, both in the history faculty and in the college she attended there. So she's getting her due in that way. And again, I'm hoping that the work that I've been able to do will bring both her life and her work sort of, you know, back to us today.
My guest tonight has been Professor Barbara D. Savage. She is a historian and Geraldine R. Siegel Professor of American Social Thought at the University of Pennsylvania. And we've been talking about her latest book. It is a dynamic biography. Merz Tate, The Global Odyssey of a Black Woman Scholar. Professor Savage, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.